Hey man, how's it going, y'all? Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Skull Horton Show. How's it going with you guys and stuff? Should be a good show for you today. Gareth Porter's going to be on. Continue. It'll be part 6 in our series on his new book, Manufactured Crisis. In regards to Chapter 7, IAEA comes up empty. Yeah. Same as always. Continue to verify the non-diversion declared income materials. And Sheldon Richmond's going to be on the show. And we're going to be talking about Ukraine and some other things. And then also, I'm going to be talking about some other things. So, hang tight for that. Oh, I'm still trying to get a hold of Winslow Wheeler. I don't know. I guess not. And that Landay, I want to interview Landay. He's been writing all about this whole, he's the guy who's broke the story and followed up 6 times or 5 times or something on the story of the Senate versus the CIA on who's allowed to look at which documents and all of that. And it's a big deal, and yeah, he's just a busy guy. He's hard to get on the show. But I'm working on it. And then Winslow Wheeler, he's good at counting defense, as they call them, defense dollars. And I was hoping I could give you guys a chance to overhear what he's got to say about how many dollars are being spent on American militarism every year. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe I'll hear from him. Maybe I won't. But that's all right, because we still got good old Sheldon, and he's got a new piece about, well, not just about Ukraine, but he's got a whole other piece. Well, remember last week's about the Empire. I want to ask him, first of all, about this article by Robert Kaplan in The Atlantic, In Defense of the Empire. And about how wonderful it all is. So we'll have Sheldon talk a little bit about that. And then his latest on Ukraine is really good. Did Team Obama blunder or conspire in Ukraine? Well, maybe it was a really dumb conspiracy. I'm not sure. We're going to find out from Sheldon Richmond. Alright, so now to some news. Special report, Iraqi forces, images, testify to atrocities in new fighting. And, oh hey, it's Ned Parker, used to be for the LA Times, here he is writing for Reuters. I've interviewed him before, on Iraq. Back when? He writes, the video shows a male corpse lying in the dirt, one end of a rope tied around his legs, the other fastened to the back of an armored Humvee. Men in Iraqi military uniforms mingle by the vehicle. Someone warns there might be a bomb on the body. One hands another his smartphone. Then he stands over the body, smiles, and offers a thumbs up as his comrade takes a photo. The Humvee starts to move, dragging the dead man behind it in the desert. A short video was shown to Reuters last week by an Iraqi national police officer. It captures what appears to be Iraqi soldiers desecrating the corpse of a fighter from the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, a group reconstituted from an earlier incarnation of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Which is correct. This is very normal, said the Baghdad-based police officer, who has many friends now fighting around the Sunni city of Ramadi. Our guys get killed at the hands of Al-Qaeda. Why don't we do the same to them? This is self-defense. Almost 3 months after Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki declared war on Sunni militants in Iraq's western Anbar province, the fighting seems to have descended into a series of brutal atrocities, often caught on video and photographs by both militants and Iraqi soldiers. Iraqi soldiers say they are bogged down in a slow, vicious fight with ISIL and other, which is ISIS, same thing, and other Sunni factions in the city of Ramadi and around Fallujah. They describe a hellish world in which Iraqi forces are running low on tank shells, lack aerial cover, are short of armored vehicles, and have been hit by high casualties and desertion rates. More than 380,000 people have fled their homes to escape the fighting, according to the United Nations. Anyway, I don't want to go on too long reading. Point is just to remind you a little bit that Iraq, 11 years after the American invasion, is an absolute hellhole. And it's not just the Al-Qaeda fighters who are fighting for their own totalitarian state and all that, but it's the regular Sunni tribes. Ooh, man, sneezes come in twos for me most times. It's not just the Al-Qaeda guys. It's the Sunni tribes have gone back to war against the Shiite government that America and Iran stalled in power there. And, of course, the Iraqi government, they, you know, always, just the same as the Americans did when they were occupying the place, they always pretend that all of their opposition among the Sunni-based insurgency is just Al-Qaeda guys, but it's really not the case. And the point being that the surge failed. The point being that they never did achieve any of those benchmarks other than they made a deal with Sadr, and they beat up on him for about 6 months, and then they made a deal with him that we'll stop beating up on you if you'll stop beating up on us. Truce was made there. And really, Maliki worked it out with him more than the Americans did. And then they accept the Sunni tribal leaders' offer that had been made, and we count them all up on the show. I wish I still knew all of my footnotes for each and every one of these individual stories. I used to actually be able to recite it all off the top of my head. But in 2003, in 2004, 5, and 6, in the summer, at least, the Sunni tribal leaders would offer the same deal to the Americans. We'll stop fighting you if you'll just let us patrol our own neighborhoods, basically keep the neighborhoods we've got left now, and stop fighting us. Maybe give us a little bit of money and authority. And the American position all the way up until Bush finally hired Petraeus was, no, we will crush you. No, you resist us, we will destroy you. Remember George Bush said, kick ass. There are a series of moments, and this is one of them. He said. That was his war plan. Anyway, so Petraeus told George Bush, if you want to win this war, you got to let me make a deal with these guys. We're not going to defeat them. We're going to make a deal with them. And Bush said, okay. So, in essence, the complete and total sum of the surge victory was in temporarily bribing the Sunni resistance to not fight anymore, or to fight Al-Qaeda, limit Al-Qaeda and their role in exchange for, you know, the Americans to stop attacking them. And the thing of it is, they already had lost Baghdad. And so, you know, as Alex Coburn, or no, pardon me, as Patrick Coburn put on the show back then, you know, in real time as all this was going on, they had three enemies. They had the Shiite government that the Americans and the Iranians had put in power there. They had the American occupation. And then they also had the Al-Qaeda suicide bomber guys who were trying to, you know, literally create a state, right? The Islamic State of Iraq is sort of a fantasy. But they were trying to actually say that they were the government of the Sunni tribes. And the Sunni tribal leaders then bucked and said, no, you're the help. And, in fact, kicked their asses and marginalized them, although they obviously did not get rid of them entirely. And then that was just cover for the Americans to leave, kicked out by the Maliki government that they had successfully installed in power in Baghdad with the help of the Iranians. That didn't need them anymore because they're the majority and they're friends with the Iranians in the country next door, so they really don't need us. So thanks for everything. Now beat it, Maliki said, and kicked the Americans out. That's the only success that came out of the surge. All the benchmarks were never reached. The benchmarks were that Maliki was supposed to invite the Sunnis into the government, invite the Sunni fighters into the police and the military, and invite the Sunni tribal leaders into the state to participate in their so-called representative democracy. But that never happened. No, at the end of the day, democracy just means majority rule. Minority, especially the former minority that backed the former dictator there, the current minority that backed the former dictator, they get stuck out. They get left with nothing. And that's what they're fighting about now. And more than 1,000 people died in January, hundreds and hundreds in February, hundreds and hundreds more this month. All because of the American invasion and turned that country upside down. In 2003. Hey, all Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first. And just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at ScottHorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. And yeah, man, you know, the scale of death and pain and horror and grief and lasting consequences from the Iraq War compared to the amount of discussion about those realities, it just seems so out of whack to me. It's just completely unfair. And I know that Americans have been sick and tired of hearing about Iraq since 2003, since 2004. As soon as it was obvious that, one, they lied you into it, and two, it's not going to be easy. They're going to have to go to hell and back before they can get things, bribe everybody to get everything, you know, eye of the storm peaceful enough to leave, to get kicked out, and save face. They said, forget it. By 2005, 2006, the American people had never even heard of such a thing. And then when they did, it was, oh man, it's going so bad that you gotta stay even longer. You gotta double down. Anyway. But I don't care, because it still matters to me. And I don't think it's right that people get to just ignore it. And, you know, especially when so much is known about the guilt of those who came up with this premeditated murder plot to get us into Iraq and how they did it. And everybody knows who they are, and they were all guilty of war crimes. Starting an aggressive war, that's the supreme war crime. That wasn't a preemptive war against a threat. Hell, they didn't even really sell it as a preemptive war against a threat. They sold it as a preventive war. They didn't really try to lie and say, no, really, there's an imminent attack. They defined imminent like Obama that, you know, look, we know he hates us over there. He could attack us one day, they said. And so they're guilty of war crimes. That's it. F Saddam. We're taking him out, Bush announced in barging into an Oval Office meeting in the spring of 2002. And they did announce. Just go back in your own memory what you already know. They announced at the end of 01 and the beginning of 02 that the policy is regime change. And Saddam, yeah, we're going to regime change him. And for lots of different reasons, but okay, yeah, if it's weapons that scare you, yeah, weapons, lots of weapons. And then they proceeded to come up with a bunch of crap. Aluminum tubes for an advanced nuclear weapons program in Iraq that nobody knew about, huh? Come on. It was nonsense. And then Colin Powell goes before the United Nations with cartoon drawing artist renderings of mobile biological weapons labs, Well, listen, if Saddam Hussein had mobile biological weapons labs, they would possibly look a lot like the ones in these cartoons. It's not quite Adlai Stevenson with the satellite pictures of the nuclear missiles in Cuba, is it? And they're guilty. And the reason they did it is, one, because it would be embarrassing to take the risk of Bush losing power and leaving power after 4 years with Saddam still in the chair. That's embarrassment to daddy. It's embarrassment to the Bush family name. That's his reason. And then for Karl Rove, we want to get him reelected to make sure, you know, it's not an issue no matter what. And war presidents get bonus points. Don't want to change horses in midstream and all that. He's just thinking of the math. And then Dick Cheney, of course, had run Halliburton into the ground with all of his bad, lousy business decisions. I don't know. I mean, they knew he wasn't a businessman, but they knew he was a crony and could hook them up to the American Treasury. He was really not able to do that very well. I mean, hell, they built Camp Bondsteel. Must have made a fortune off of that, but Cheney had to make it up to Halliburton by getting them a bunch of government contracts. That's easy enough. And then, you know, the energy policy, as Greg Palast teaches, about redlining Iraqi oil and keeping it off the market in order to keep the Saudis in the catbird seat running OPEC and not having much competition from Iran or Iraq, you know, which that could be a problem that Saudis are really worried about now, is Iraq and Iran working together now that they're allies, now that America's regime changed Iraq for them. That really is a threat to Saudi hegemony. But anyway, that was probably a lot of what they thought they were doing there. And then the guys that really made sure that it all went down in the media and inside the government were Cheney's men and Ariel Sharon's men, coincidentally the very same men, the neoconservatives. And that's in the vice president's office, of course, Libby and Hannah, and I guess Rode was in the vice president's office too, right? Rody. And then you had Stephen Hadley working for Condoleezza Rice as the deputy national security advisor. And then over in the State Department, it was Wormser and Bolton. Although Bolton isn't really a neocon, he's just a right-wing nationalist type. He was never a commie. The rest of these guys, almost to a man, they're either used to be commies, or at least they used to be Democrats, and they were taught by used to be commies, like Wolfstetter and Strauss and Irving Kristol. Over at the Pentagon, you had Richard Perle on the Defense Policy Board with Newt Gingrich co-conspiring with him all the time. And then he doesn't get much coverage. There's one really good article about Gingrich's role in lying us into war, intimidating the CIA for Libby and Cheney. Remember the 14 trips to CIA? Well, Newt Gingrich had a whole separate set of his own. Anyway, and then Paul Wolfowitz and Doug Feith and Abram Shulsky. Well, Wolfowitz was the Deputy Secretary of Defense, and then Feith was the Deputy Secretary of Defense for Policy. And then working for him was a guy named Abram Shulsky and Bill Luddy, who he was a military guy working for Cheney, ex-military guy, retired, you know, back in there as a civilian working for Cheney. I don't think he was really a neocon, but more of a right-wing type and friendly with this crew anyway. And then in the Office of Special Plans under Douglas Feith and Abram Shulsky, he had a whole gaggle of neocons, including Michael Ledeen and Michael Rubin. And, man, I'm probably forgetting a few. But then anyway, and then you had the entire network out in the media and all the think tanks as well. You had the American Enterprise Institute, the Project for a New American Century, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and the Center for Security Policy, and all of these groups, especially PNAC and AEI. I mean, GENSA was, yeah, and anyway, and then they also, all these neocons at these think tanks also were extremely influential in all of the newspaper editorial pages. So you had Robert Kagan at the Washington Post, and you have, and Charles Kruthammer, and then over at the New York Times, well, you had Bill Kristol for a while there, I guess Thomas Friedman, he wasn't really one of the neocons, but he was really bad on all of this stuff. I'm trying to think which neocons wrote for the New York Times. Anyway, and then, of course, the National Review and the Weekly Standard and all that Fox News promoted material. on the right. These were the guys who caused that war. And what they did, in fact, here's some great journalism about it. First two on the list would be Julian Borger in The Guardian, The Spies Who Pushed for War, and then Bob Dreyfus in The Nation, Agents of Influence. And both of those articles show that Ariel Sharon had created his own Office of Special Plans in the Prime Minister's office over there in Israel to manufacture bogus intelligence in English to funnel straight into the pipeline. And that's covered by both of those authors there. It's also covered by James Bamford in his book, A Pretext for War, 9/11 Iraq and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agencies. And then Seymour Hersh, of course, wrote all about the neocons in the Bush years. But as far as lying us into war, there was a two-part thing, the stovepipe and selective intelligence. They call themselves the cabal. Yeah, we know they do. And then, of course, The Lie Factory by Bob Dreyfus and Jason Vest and Mother Jones is great. Pentagon Home Office to Neocon Network by Jim Loeb about the Office of Special Plans. Karen Katowski has the new Pentagon Papers in Salon.com and a three-part series beginning with In Rumsfeld's Shop in the American Conservative Magazine. And then there's How the Neocons Conquered Washington and Launched a War by Michael Lind at antiwar.com. That's a really great one. And in fact, Jason Leopold was writing about the Office of Special Plans. Oh, and in fact, here's what you do. Just go to McClatchyDC.com. Or do you know how to do this? Search site, just to choose one site to search only. But you don't want to use the site's built-in search. It's going to suck. You want to use Google or whatever. And you say site, colon, McClatchyDC.com. And then what you'll want to do is type in Strobel, because he doesn't even really write for them, but his name is on a bunch of stuff there because they have the archive of all of the Lande and Strobel and all of the Knight Ridder crew articles of all of what they wrote about the Office of Special Plans and the Neocon project to lie us into war with Iraq back in 2002 and 2003. And in fact, at the time that Dick Cheney gave his Veterans of Foreign Wars speech, where he lied his ass off to the veterans of World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, and said, give me your sons to go do this. I need them. It's an emergency because of these weapons. The damned liar that right then CIA guys, and I mean regular schmucks at CIA, not the leadership, regular schmucks at CIA picked up the phone and they called John Lande and they said, man, I got to talk to you about what a terrible liar Dick Cheney is. There is no new intelligence on Iraq. They don't have anything. What are you talking about? I'll tell you what's going on here. It's the Pentagon. Over there they have the Office of Special Projects. That's what Lande called it in his first report. He got the name of that wrong. I'm sure it was his source's fault, not Lande's fault. And that was in the summer of 2002. A story was already breaking out all over that all of this intelligence is just being made up. And, you know, Justin Raimondo wrote at antiwar.com back in, it was October, early October 2002, the fix is in. Or this was even probably in September of 2002. The fix is in. Joe Biden, the chair, our current vice president, chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, is making sure that his so-called check and balance before they vote for this war is a bunch of fake-ass hearings with a parade of pro-war monger liars up there. So the Democrats are just as guilty in climbing on board with George Bush for that murder plot. It still bleeds to this day. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state, available at scotthorton.org/Amazon. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org. nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. offnow.org. Yeah, forget that. Hey, you know, the other thing about Iraq that I forgot to get a chance to say here, too, is about the long-term consequences, not just the horror show that is the state of Iraq right now, but the long-term consequences as they go forward from here. I'll refer you again to this very important series. It's going to be 5 parts tall. I think they're already on part 4 by Patrick Coburn in the London Independent. It's all being reproduced at independent.co.uk. Oh, no, that's what I said. It's being reproduced at uns.com. And it's a 5-part series on the revival and the spread of al-Qaeda because of America's war in Iraq, including, of course, spreading to Libya and especially spreading into Syria. And, you know, where there are now millions of refugees and hundreds of thousands of people killed and an Iraq-level disaster playing itself out in Syria right now. That's a direct result of America's war there. And then, of course, the empowering of Iran and their, you know, they're as tight as any two states in the world are, the government in Baghdad and the government in Tehran, and that's another consequence of American intervention there. And even though, as we talked about with Gareth Porter yesterday, they didn't work with the Iranians the whole time that they were working with them to install that government in power there. It's completely ridiculous. And then, of course, the future of Kurdistan is war, because the Kurds will eventually declare independence somewhere. Some portion of the Kurdish nation will declare independence from Iraq probably first. And then there's going to be war with Iran and Syria and parts of Turkey and Azerbaijan, and God knows what's going to happen there. And that's to play out in the decades to come. And of course, because of the Shiite takeover of Baghdad, that means that every Sunni government in the region is terrified and has, you know, what they believe anyway is great reason to try to intervene to change that. So that's a hell of a lot more blood still to be spilled, all because of George Bush's premeditated murder plot in Iraq in 2003. Anyway, sorry, just had to wrap that up real quick.
Start. When's that series going to start?
To our first guest on the show today, Sheldon Richman. Sorry for talking over your interview like that for so long there, Sheldon, but I didn't quite get to finish up on Iraq, and I want to since it's 11th anniversary week and all of that. Sheldon Richman, he's the vice president of the Future Freedom Foundation, and he's the editor of their monthly journal, The Future of Freedom. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and always great to be with you.
Good, good. Very happy to have you here. And, you know, I don't ever mention your own website, Free Association, at SheldonRichman.com enough, but it's a hell of a
That's
great
right.
blog. People ought to go back and look through that thing.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, there you go. All right, so... lots to talk about here. I'm not sure which all order to take it in. I guess, first of all, did you see the Robert Kaplan piece in defense of empire in the Atlantic today?
Yes, I did.
Read it. So we just talked about this from the exact opposite point of view, of course, a week ago for your last piece about how America's always been an empire. And I thought, you know, I don't know, man, in a way, I just completely reject every bit of this, right? But I want to try to be fair to him, even if he is the devil, and see if you can really, you know, I'll do my best anyway to be the devil's advocate here and make you defend a complete Switzerland foreign policy for America, or even statelessness that couldn't possibly intervene anywhere without a state to intervene for this society when the whole rest of the world is in jeopardy. For those who haven't seen it, basically he makes the unapologetic case for the white man's burden, as he puts it, that the rest of the world is chaos, Stan, and we gotta put him in line. And so he says if there's one honest criticism about Western imperialism, especially American imperialism, it might be how expensive it is. And so we better be really careful how we implement it because we don't want to spend too much money. But other than that, you're damn right those foreigners need to do it our way or else. Because after all, and he sort of has a point, their way sucks, man. Their way is all tribalism and ethno-nationalism and constant warfare, not like our enlightened kind.
Well, yeah, you know, some years ago there were what we called cheap hawks. Barry Hart was one of them. Now we have cheap imperialists, because Kaplan is concerned with the cost, and so he wants a more modest empire. He says we ought to be really careful about where we put troops, and, you know, otherwise we should kind of keep things under control, but try to have, you know, we don't have to do it directly where that's possible. And so at least he's a fiscally responsible imperialist, I guess we could say. Yeah, his thesis, which you also see from Neil Ferguson and Deepak Lal and probably Max Boot and a whole bunch of them, Weekly Standard types, is that you do need an empire. In other words, and when they say empire, they mean like de facto world government. That's what they mean. Because who's going to keep the sea lanes open and the airspace open and make sure trade flows and keep these tribes from fighting each other? But he left out a whole lot of stuff. I mean, all the violence perpetrated by the British in taming the heathen, not to mention the Americans when they were building their empire, namely slaughtering Indians and slaughtering Filipinos. And he kind of just sort of let that go. And then also he didn't really spend a whole lot of time reminding us that World War I and World War II occurred during his Age of Empire. That doesn't seem to go very well on the empire's resume, right? The British were dominant when World War I comes along, and still pretty dominant, and the U.S. was rising when World War II comes along. It certainly didn't prevent world wars. So, I'm not persuaded by this argument that we need a big empire, of course it's the U.S. that he's got in mind, to keep the peace, or else everyone's going to be each other's throats. You know, most of the world is not at war. There have been arguments from various people. Jim Payne has a very good book called The History of Force that shows that the warfare, when you really look at the big picture and the long stretch of history, that kind of violence has been diminishing. I mean, most countries are not at war with each other, and it's not because the U.S. Stands ready, between every little state, ready to stop it or be the referee or the traffic cop. So it's an unimpressive thesis. It just seems to me he wants to justify American hegemonic rule, but he's conscious of the fiscal crisis going on, so he's found a way to scale it back a bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, it seems to me too that I don't know what the guy's thinking really, but the shallowness of the excuse is revealed by the lies of omission. I mean, he starts the thing by saying, I admit that I don't really even know what's his point of bringing this up and framing it this way, but he says, I admit the British should have done a better job of protecting the Iraqi Jews back when they controlled Iraq. And then he seems to be saying, but, we do a lot better job of things like that. But, of course, he never gets back to the American occupation of Iraq and the fact that there are now less than a dozen Jews left in the entire country, and that all the Yazidis and the Turkmen and the Assyrian and Chaldean Christians and all of those minority ethnic and religious civilizations have been completely obliterated. They're all now dying in a Syrian refugee camp somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
He knows he's full of it when he doesn't. He brings up minority rights in Baghdad, but then he doesn't dare go back to that subject because what the hell are you talking about, man? Come on, America's done the worst for the people of Iraq, for especially the minorities of Iraq, than anybody since Genghis Khan.
No, it's a good point. If he's going to start talking about Baghdad, you think it might have been on his mind that the U.S. Basically sponsored ethnic cleansing of Baghdad. The last decade, so
completely ridiculous. So
that's true. And I didn't mention things like 9/11. The things when you're an empire, people resent it, and they often try to do something about it. Well, we saw what happened on 9/11. We saw people annoyed with the U.S. empire and finally trying to get a little bit of revenge. So what's he talking about keeping order? I just don't see this point. And, you know, better that things be decentralized, and if there's going to be wars, let them be isolated and local rather than be expanded by things like NATO. I mean, that's always, you know, that's always been the big flaw there. They think that the way to reduce violence is to join in local orgies of violence, which just makes things worse.
Yeah, it's funny. He almost sounds like a utopian one-world commie type, like H.G. Wells. I forget which movie or which book it is where they end up with a one-world Air Force that just, if anybody makes trouble anywhere in the world, they just bomb them until they stop making trouble, and then everybody lives happily ever after that. Remember that one? Were they the one-world Air Force of utopian?
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, America's supposed to be like the school principal, right? And if it catches a fight in the hallway, he's going to be right there, and then disciplining the two, the two punks are fighting. You know, it doesn't take into account public choice analysis, which means there's going to be mission creep and self-serving missions, and none of that's there. It's like all this ideal. Oh, I just have the ideal utopian government in mind that's going to do exactly what I think is right and nothing else. There's no sense of the real world dynamics. It's known as the Nirvana fallacy, right? You think your utopian ideal is what's actually going to obtain in reality if you get your way. But that's naive. It's and I'm sure he's not naive, so it's dishonest.
Yeah. Well, and especially when, you know, you just take account of what's going on in the world right now. We back military dictatorships and sultans and emirs and kings and revolutions of suicide bombing lunatics and sometimes neo-Nazis across the planet Earth. I mean, who's being done a favor here?
You know? Backing neo-Nazis, that hasn't happened for a couple of months. What are you complaining about?
Yeah.
Come on, well, don't dredge up ancient history.
We gotta bring up old stuff all the time, Scott. Oh, that guy's the Attorney General of Ukraine now. Oops.
You gotta look forward. You know, as Obama says, we have to look ahead. Let's not no recriminations.
Crazy. All right, now, but wait a minute here. So there's a guy named Basevich. You know him, Andrew Basevich. Writes great anti-imperialist type of stuff a lot of times. And he was always my pick for Ron Paul's Secretary of Defense if they hadn't stolen the nomination from Ron Paul. Yeah. He would have been a great Secretary of Defense for Ron. And anyway, but so I was interviewing him one time, and I was saying, and he's a very pragmatic guy. I know you're very familiar with him. He can speak from a very dispassionate, amoral American national strategist point of view. And he says, hell yes, we ought to get out of the Middle East. We're not doing a thing over there but causing trouble. But no way in the world should we get out of the Far East, because right now we are what's creating and maintaining that delicate balance of power that keeps Japan and China from going back to war. These guys got some ancient enmities, and they got some border disputes, and we are the superpower. We're the gorilla in the room that keeps them apart. And we're the reason, our security guarantee is why Japan does not rearm and even go nuclear weapons hot, right? And we're the reason that the Chinese don't even bother thinking twice about invading Taiwan and taking back Taiwan, because we're there to keep it that way. And so now, if Ron Paul's in charge, or if you have your way, Sheldon, then that means that possibly could lead to major power conflict in a place where, at least according to Basevich, we seem to be keeping the warring factions apart. Maybe throw in the Korean Peninsula there. I'm not saying you have to agree with the premise of the question, by the way, but seems like an honest one. Oh, and crap, now we got to take a break, and I'll let you answer that when we get back from the break. It's Sheldon Richman from FFF.org. Sorry about that. I'm really lousy at this. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know Your Enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We're on Liberty Express Radio and Daily Paul Radio and Liberty Radio Network and Anomaly Radio and ARS Radio and Radio. ScottHorton.org/listen. You can also find all my archives there at ScottHorton.org. You can join up the chat room there at ScottHorton.org/chat. You can follow me on Twitter at Twitter.com/ScottHortonShow. Enough already. Okay, so now, back to Sheldon Richman. And the question is, yeah, but Sheldon, collective security is sort of kind of keeping the peace somewhere, possibly. And so, what if we take our finger out of the dike and all hell breaks loose and major powers go to war with each other?
Well, look, aside from the fact that for the U.S. to be the policeman of the Far East, for it to do that, it has to violate the rights of Americans through taxation and other things. We know what happens when the government has a big military establishment. It eventually comes home, and of course that's already happened. So it has implications domestically regarding surveillance and other sorts of things, the military industrial complex. Aside from all those problems, it just presumes that the policymakers, who are mere mortals, let's remember, they're not demigods, maybe demigods, but they're not demigods. It presumes they have the knowledge it takes to, enter into a complicated situation and manage things. And, more often than not, you got to expect that that's going to backfire and not only hurt people there, but hurt us as well. He may be attributing the lack of a war between China and Japan to the United States, but I don't know how he can be certain of that. I think you need to bet that the government, being a bull in the China shop, is going to sooner or later mess things up. So let's not have our blood on our hands.
Well, especially look at that situation in Korea, where, the reason that the Chinese are willing to continue propping up that commie dictatorship, the actual commie dictatorship there, land of starvation and darkness, real totalitarianism, is because it keeps the Americans down there at the 38th parallel, man. And if they reunify Korea, then, that'll just bring the Americans that much closer, back up to the Yalu River. And so they would just as soon, keep the North Korean people enslaved under the Kim Jong-un regime, which is, of course, I guess it seems to be fine with the Americans, too, because they don't want to see nuclear North Korea combined with capitalist South Korea, or, pseudo-capitalist South Korea, in a way that would make the recombined Korea an actual Pacific power in its own right, rather than just a satellite of ours. So,
well, I've actually read, and this might have come from Doug Bondo, who, of course, is a Korea watcher from way back, that the Chinese don't want the U.S. to leave the peninsula because they're afraid if there's chaos in the north, North Koreans will pour into China, which they don't want. So there are many counterintuitive things going on there.
Yep. Well, Fitz in the chat room is saying, if we let Japan build a nuke, then, Beijing and Tokyo be at standoff, and just like every other set of nuclear powers in the world. I mean, hell, it keeps the peace between India and Pakistan mostly. I mean, they have border skirmishes from time to time, but they never go to outright war now that they have nukes. I mean, so far, cross fingers.
Look, I think there's something to that. And, of course, none of us should be comfortable or sleeping totally sound at night with nukes in the world. I mean, I was saying earlier on another program that, the number one priority regarding China, Russia and the U.S., and I've heard you say something like this, it should be dismantling the nuclear arsenal. I mean, that ought to be the top priority, and I don't know why people are not screaming about that instead of talking about Crimea.
I need another Steve Guttenberg movie, ABC movie of the week about what a nuclear war would look like in your neighborhood. That was pretty effective propaganda back then. They say it sort of shocked Ronald Reagan. He thought, man, that really would be ugly, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, good point. And I heard you saying that, and I think this is right, that people seem to think that on the Christmas Day of 1991, when the hammer and sickle came down for the last time, that somehow the nukes just disappeared, just vanished into thin air like that Malaysian airliner.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, they say that they retargeted them away from their targets, but still, it's just a matter of punching in the same coordinates from the list again. And
well, and I heard Andrew Mitchell say today that they're not on hair trigger any longer.
Yeah. I'm not going to take anyone in her family's word for anything.
That's my attitude, too. And besides, how long does it take to turn a couple of keys anyway, right?
Right. Well, and you know, and anybody can Google this if you want to freak everybody out at dinner tonight or whatever. Go and look up the 20-something times that there almost was an accidental war between America and Russia based on a misinterpreted satellite launch or some misinterpreted tic-tac-toe results or, you know, whatever kind of thing. There's about 20 of those over the years. Yes, I know that's a movie reference, but there's about 20 of those over the years where they almost went to war, and then usually it's got some great story, like one guy refused to follow the chain of command and his orders because his gut instinct was that this can't be right. And thank goodness, because if he had passed on the pseudo information, then we'd have lost New York City over it, you know?
Well, yeah, we should be more nervous about that, and they should be getting much more attention, but people think it went away. So I have to disagree with Professor Vesevich on this, and I just think it's asking for trouble.
Well, yeah, anyway, so there you go. I'm trying to find, like, some kind of depth here to try to defend or, you know, a position to really try to take, but it all just seems kind of ridiculous. And, of course, the whole article here goes, and we're not talking Vesevich, we're talking about Robert Kaplan here, in defense of empire in the Atlantic. The whole thing just ignores the existence of individual human beings and their right to not be murdered whatsoever. That's just not even part of it at all. He just talks about, well, you know, after this particular European power conquered that particular group of people somewhere else on the planet, years later, they do better or whatever. You know, these kinds of very broad strokes that deny actual humanity. And a lot of broad assertions of power, too, that, well, without the U.S. Navy, there could be no globalization. Well, I mean, really? Why not? Which power is going to intercept all shipments on the high seas if the U.S. Navy isn't there to protect them, you know?
Right. Besides, let the business companies, that you know, the companies that want to ship goods, pay for their own protection of their ships or planes. Right. Why should those costs be socialized? That gives unfair advantage to the big global companies versus smaller companies, because instead of the price of that security showing up in the price of goods, which put them at some competitive disadvantage to other companies, we pay it as taxpayers, and so it doesn't show up at the cash register. That's unfair. I mean, that's a lot like government subsidizing railroads. Yeah. Which of course the U.S. government did in the 19th century, which allowed the growth of, which, you know, deliberately engineered national market and created behemoth companies that had advantages because of socialized costs over smaller local and regional companies.
I think you just came across a great reason for liberals to oppose empire, even while Democrats are in power, because it's just welfare for Walmart, so that they don't have to pay for all their own security costs on the high seas to outsource all those jobs and everything. Union
jobs.
Right.
I don't see why that's seen as a government job to keep sea lanes open. Companies can pay for that if that's what they want to do. If that means there's less globalization, okay, so there's less globalization. It's just like, you know, people argue, well, if you don't have eminent domain, we won't have such large airports. And the answer is, okay, so we won't have such large airports.
Yeah. Boy, and don't even get me started on the corporate welfare for the airlines. You know, like upper middle class and rich people have a right to fly that all working folk have a duty to subsidize. You know what? Walk.
Yeah.
You know, I get tired of that, man. I mean, there are people who never fly in a plane their whole life, but they sure pay for other people's way all day and night. Ain't right. All right.
Well, and that's just like, you know, owners of passenger automobiles pay a disproportionate amount of money to repair the interstate highways, which is a subsidy to the big trucking and shipping shippers that move the stuff across the country. They don't pay the full cost of the damage they do to the roads. They do most of the damage to the roads, not cars, but we owners of cars pay most of the repair cost. That's a subsidy.
The state, it's just a gigantic welfare program for business. In this society.
Right, and most of the welfare goes up. That's right.
All right, we're almost out of time for this segment, so I guess I'll ask you if you wouldn't mind hanging through the news, and then we could do one segment on Ukraine, or I can let you go, depending on your schedule.
I can hang on.
Okay, great. Well, you can go ahead and take a break. Because it's about a 6-minute news break coming up here.
Okay.
I guess I started saying that a little bit early. But anyway, it's Sheldon Richman. He's the vice president of the Future Freedom Foundation. And he is the editor of their monthly journal, The Future of Freedom. And he's got two great articles here. Today's is The American Disease. We got to talk about that. And which, you know, goes along with what we've been talking about a little bit. And then also he's got this great one about Ukraine and just how accidentally on purpose the Democrats' big blunder there is. So we're going to find out all about that on the other side of this break. It's the Scott Horton Show, scotthorton.org, libertyexpressradio.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Sheldon Richman from the Future Freedom Foundation. He's the vice president there and the editor of their journal, The Future of Freedom. His website is sheldonrichman.com. Free Association is the blog there. Free as a tethered ass. that's the slogan over there at Free Association. And now, before we move on to the Ukraine rundown here, because you got a great write-up on what's going on over there for the FFF, but you also have this thing that's out today, The American Disease, and this goes along with the hypocrisy of all that white man's burden crap we were just talking about, Robert Kaplan's article in The Atlantic about all of that. And this is about, you focus mostly on something that really caught my attention, too, when I read this interview with Stephen F. Cohen in Newsweek. He's the guy who, I believe he's married to the editor of The Nation, Katrina Vandenheuvel, or however you say it. And he is, as they call him in Newsweek, the man who dared to defend Putin, which means who dared to tell the truth about what was going on in Ukraine lately, rather than just towing the party line. And because it was such a contentious interview, he does really well because he's pushing back hard against the guy interviewing him, accusing him, basically. And so, he therefore is quite energetic and is pretty broad-ranging in his thinking and the examples that he brought up and all this and that. And then, but the part that I'm talking about, of course, is the blowback for homosexuals in Russia, since the American government especially, but American society really, decided that they're our pets to defend from their evil tyrant, Vladimir Putin.
Well, that's right. The general point, and what I mean by the disease is the people who catch the disease are opposition movements in foreign countries that are not allies of the United States. So when a movement arises to oppose an authoritarian government in a country that is not an ally of the U.S., in other words, a government that U.S. might want to see disappear or replaced, given America's history, the opposition movement is immediately going to be tarred as agents of the CIA or the National Endowment for Democracy, in other words, of America. And that's not an unreasonable assumption, given America's history. Certainly since World War II, it's always had covert operations. These days it's by a non-government organization that gets tons of taxpayer money, but that goes in there and gives advice on how to do regime change or how to have street mobs or whatever, just like it occurred in Ukraine and probably what was going on in Egypt. And it goes back to 1953, and right in the overthrow of Mossadegh and to restore the Shah. So the disease is the U.S., by its history and activity, infects even genuine opposition movements against genuinely odious governments. And it just lets the odious government use the nationalist club against them by telling their people, you know, the population, look, that group there, that opposition group, they're just fronts for American agents and American interests and the IMF and neoliberalism and, you know, capitalism. So this history and this policy has done a disservice to the cause of liberty worldwide, not anything in their favor. And what grabbed me about Cohen's point was, like you said, I'm sure American officials thought they were doing the gaze of Russia a great favor by standing up and condemning that law that Putin signed that says you can't distribute information about non-traditional sexual lives to minors. It was a vague law that could probably capture a lot of people who weren't even doing anything regarding minors. It might have felt good to stand up and condemn that and snub Putin regarding the Olympics, but what it did was hurt the Russian gaze, and that's what Cohen was pointing out. I mean, he's lived there, he knows lots of people, he has friends, he knows Russian gaze, and they were telling him this is bad. Shut up already. You know, he has one quote. I won't give it verbatim, but he said a friend of his said that before all this, We were homosexuals. Now we're American homosexuals. And he even knows of legislators who said, I would have voted to get rid of this law, but I can't do it now because America has weighed in. So it hurts the very cause we say, when I say we, the government says it's attempting to advance. It hurts. It sets it back. And I don't think that was their aim anyway. They just wanted to club Putin over the head.
Yep. Well,
I don't think they cared what the consequences were going to be. They just wanted to club Putin over the head and win some, public relations campaign against him. That's it. They don't care what the real facts are on the ground, how it hurt real people. They don't care about that. They don't think about that.
Right. After all, Barack Obama's only been politically correct on the gay marriage issue since after he was reelected, right? His whole first term, yeah, he was against gay marriage, for example, and I think the way Cohen says it is like, yeah, Russia, it's really backwards on this issue. It reminds me of where I grew up just a generation and a half ago, whatever, you know. Definitely have a lot of progress to make, but they got to make it. And by the way, just for the context, the quote was that yesterday I was the F word slang for homosexual. So not just homosexual, but the terrible, like, dehumanizing slang for it. And now I'm an American, one of those, meaning even that much lower, because now I'm a traitor, too. Now I'm a fifth column working for the CIA. You know, that's the point. And we saw that same thing, of course, in Iran with the whole Green Revolution. And really, before the Green Revolution, any kind of student group that says we'd like, you know, less law and more representation, that kind of thing, you know, personal restrictions, whatever. Immediately they're labeled tools of the Westerners, tools of the CIA especially.
Right, and the NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, you know, is a neocon infested organization. It's run by Carl Gershman, who's tied in with Robert Kagan and all these people, and, you know, cheered on by Victoria Nuland and the State Department. And they're in there meddling and doing all kinds of stuff to bring the neoliberal program, which means, you know, IMF recommending higher taxes on real people. So they get it automatically taints any opposition movement. That's the disease, that we infect them with this disease, and it's not right. We're hurting the very people. Again, I'm repeating myself, that we say we want to help. It doesn't help them. And, you know, often they tell us, thanks but no thanks, or do me a favor, don't do me any favors.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's not just that the Americans are hypocrites, but they really are dragging down and back any movement that they claim to be trying to support there. Even, like you said, even when they do mean well, which is probably part of the time or something. All right, now, anyway, I'm sorry because this segment's so short, and now we only have like a couple and a half minutes for you to talk about this piece about Ukraine. But it's the perennial question here on this show anyway, stupidity or the plan overall and in any specific circumstance. Is it a stupid plan? Did the Obama team blunder or conspire in Ukraine, Sheldon?
Well, I think, you know, they could have blundered by conspiring, but I think they conspired. I mean, I don't think it was a good conspiracy. And by that, I don't mean any kind of, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. That's not the point. I think they knew exactly what Putin was going to do, or let's say approximately what Putin was going to do by engineering regime change in Ukraine. Newland and Ambassador Pyatt, you know, taught, we all know about the tele, you've played the tape of the telephone conversation.
Did I lose you? Light's still green, you there? I think you might have hit your mute button.
No, he didn't.
Oh, well, you're back again. I heard that.
No, I didn't hit any button. So, anyway.
Some intelligence
know
agency
that...
just muted you.
That could be. So we know that the U.S. was meddling. We know about the phone call. You played the tape of Newland and Ambassador Pyatt. You know, picking out Yats as the guy and how we're going to midwife this. We need somebody to midwife this. And so it taints any real opposition. The former president. No one's saying. I'm not saying he's a good. He was a good guy. I don't know anybody who thinks he was a good guy. But he was at least being somewhat accommodating, right? He was talking about early elections and some stuff like that.
Right. Yeah, they made a deal.
That's right. That did not deter the American side from ousting the guy. Even Fareed Zakaria, who's hardly some radical libertarian, called it an extra constitutional ouster.
All right, but why? What kind of blowback? So you're saying they were willing even to lose Ukraine as a pawn on the chessboard? To what end? I mean, not Ukraine. I'm sorry, Crimea. But to what end?
Yeah. Well, I think that they gain a lot of things. They gained, first of all, they gained public relations, right? The U.S. has not been held in high esteem around the world. And so this is a chance to demonize Putin. There are business interests involved, not just the military industrial complex, but places, you know, things like Cargill. You know, if you're reading Robert Parry and other people over at the Consortium News, you can see who's gaining. But a bigger thing, and maybe Obama didn't even want this to happen, is that it drives a wedge between Russia and the U.S. on Syria and Iran. And we know who wants to see that wedge. The neoconservatives, and I have to say, the Israel lobby. And Newland is in that camp.
That's right. Kagan's wife. All right. Thanks, Sheldon. Appreciate it. FFF.org, everybody, for Sheldon Richmond. Thanks. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. NatSummit.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. So did you hear that top of the hour news? Both hours they talked about the UK going to Mali. Well, they didn't say Mali. They said the Sahel, which means, yeah, Mali. The Sahel, that means sort of kind of the southern-ish and western-ish part of the Sahara Desert in West Africa. Regular listeners of this show know, new ones don't. Hardly anyone knows about this, because hardly anyone ever talks about this. You can find a couple of good articles here, there, the other place, at Glenn Ford's writings, some things at Counterpunch, and of course at antiwar.com, but hardly anyone else has paid attention to the fact that America's war in Libya spread jihad, well, first revolution, then jihad, to Mali. Started out the Tuaregs, who many of whom worked for Gaddafi after losing the war for his side, took their weapons and went home, where the Tuaregs in northern Mali have already had somewhat autonomy up there, and they decided that's not good enough. We want a full-fledged secession from the Union and create our own Tuaregistan or whatever the hell. And they were doing all right, but then came the Al-Qaeda guys, the same ones who America had fought the war for. They came and they hijacked the Tuareg Revolution and they marched all the way down into southern Mali. And at that point, the French intervened and fought a short war and took the couple of southern Somali towns that they had taken back. And I guess went as far north as Timbuktu to secure that, I guess. And then that's about the last we've heard of it, other than, you know, the jihadi fighters were scattered. Many of them were killed. Many of them got away. And northern Mali is the size of Texas, and if you ain't never been here, that's real big. And so it's not like they can just track down every last one of these guys. They are building a massive, or have built, a massive special forces drone, you know, CIA and JSOC drone base in Niger next door. And, well, you know, they're just going to continue to chase this terror war throughout Africa. Of course, it's so easy to say, well, listen, our drone saw a guy from Mali shake hands with a guy from Niger or Nigeria. And so now the entire Boko Haram movement might as well be Al-Qaeda. So let's fight a war against them. Doesn't matter if we're fighting for Al-Qaeda in Syria right now. We still fight against them in Mali and Nigeria and Somalia and Afghanistan and Pakistan and Yemen. But not Libya and not Syria. There, the Mujahideen are our friends. And I don't know why, but yeah. I do know why, because that's what Israel wants. But anyway. Speaking of which, make sure and check out Eric Margulies' new article for LouRockwell.com tomorrow. Yeah, I get to see these things before you guys. Tomorrow on LouRockwell.com, Eric Margulies' article is about Israeli influence in the American, Saudi, Qatari, Turkish, Jordanian, Israeli plot for regime change in Syria and all the support for the Mujahideen there, as he puts it. Oh, I don't want to give it away. Read Eric Margulies at LouRockwell.com tomorrow, and I'll have him on the show on Monday. Of course, Gareth Porter's coming up in just a second, so don't go anywhere. Got some good stuff to talk about with him. I'm trying to think if there's anything about Ukraine I need to make sure and say that didn't really get mentioned in the... I don't know. I guess I'll just recommend you go read Vladimir Putin's speech. And, of course, it's very self-serving. To me, it's tragic, really. You know, what can I say? I guess somewhere deep down in my heart, I still am completely brainwashed into being some kind of American nationalist. And I'm damn embarrassed that so much of what this jerk says, I mean, he's basically the top Republican in Russia, right? He's a horrible guy. Just he's right about so much of what he says about America. It sucks. And not everything that he says in there is right, but I think pretty much everything he says in there about America is right. And not because he's good, but only because that's how wrong America is. It's easy for anyone, even a thug like Vladimir Putin, to sit down and just jot down kind of a mocking, hilarious sort of thing about what jerks you guys are and how what you tried didn't work and how do you like that. It's a disaster. I mean, this has got to go in history books, you know, that the likes of Barack Obama and John Kerry put the likes of Victoria Nuland and Gregory Pyatt in charge of their Ukraine policy. And it blew up like this. I mean, I don't care if America lost the Crimea. It ain't ours in the first place. I'm just really the only part that I regret, the only part I resent is them giving ammo to a guy like Putin to give a speech ridiculing America so effectively. You know? He could have had to stretch things, but no, he doesn't. The truth is bad enough. Pisses me off. You can read the transcript of that, the Washington Post, or a bunch of other places too, I guess. And by the way, the Russian defense minister has promised not to attack eastern Ukraine, so maybe that means they're going to the day after tomorrow. But I sure hope they don't, man. I kind of like to think that. And Putin in his speech says he's not going into eastern Ukraine. He's got Crimea, and oh yeah, the people of Ukraine, we love them. And we're going to have some real, real tight relations with them in the future. But says he has no need to invade eastern Ukraine. And I don't know if that would mean war with the Americans. I think, you know, America would probably just say, well, what the hell are you going to do? But it could. So I sure hope that they're going to leave well enough alone here. Obama's already cried uncle. Obama's already said, not only are we not going to do anything about Crimea, thank goodness, but he's also agreed that the Ukrainian constitution needs a rewrite so that the West has less control over the East, if the West is in fact going to be controlled by pro-American sock puppets. So, there's that. And thank goodness, I ain't promoting the Democrats, but man, thank God it ain't the Republicans in there right now, acting all tough. Although, you know, I don't know, Bush back down over Georgia. Romney probably would play it the same way. McCain, I don't know. McCain might get us all dead. And in fact, Romney might not have a choice, because if it was Romney, he would have had an entire administration full of neocons who might have done it much worse than this in the first place, you know? Anyway. So there's that. And then here, real quick. It's on TV. You may have heard on the top of the hour news there, they mentioned, I think, one of those hours, didn't they mention the massacre in Afghanistan? They got these elections coming up. It's one of the things I'm going to be talking about with Margulies on the show next week. I don't know who's going to win that, but on the eve of the elections, in the spring of 2014, he got a Taliban massacre at a hotel. They say the agents, France Press bureau chief and his entire family were massacred, along with several others, at this luxury hotel in Kabul. And, you know, everybody knows that the surge didn't work. I mean, the whole scam of the surge was that from the end of 2009 to the middle of 2011, they were going to kick a lot of Taliban ass hard. And then by July of 2011, they were going to bring the Taliban to the table, and they were going to dictate the terms, and them sorry Taliban sons of bitches were going to sign. And it was going to say that, okay, you guys can control the land you already control, but you can't come into Kabul, and you got to at least, you know, like the Paris Accords or whatever, give us a little bit of time after we get out before you just completely sack Saigon, I mean Kabul, kind of thing. And none of that ever happened. And the Taliban rule the whole country at night, basically. And when the Americans leave, if in fact they do leave in, you know, the largest of numbers by the end of this year, which is not altogether clear, is what's going to happen. The, you know, Obama administration has made it clear they're trying to stay. But if they do leave, if they can't get the next sock puppet in line, I guess they had to hold a quote-unquote election anyway. If they can't get the next sock puppet in line to sign the deal to keep American troops, and maybe even if they do and the troops stay, Kabul's in danger, because the best they're going to be able to do is keep, you know, like they tried in Iraq, counterterrorism forces and training forces. Yeah, but if you have just that, is that enough force protection to protect themselves? To run counterterrorism missions? Really? A few tens of thousands of guys? Maybe. But then if the Taliban really comes marching on Kabul or Kandahar, are you going to be able to do anything about it? If they decide they're just going to outright take over a city like Kandahar? I mean, what are these guys doing? Do they even have a plan? They sure as hell haven't won, right? No one's ever argued that the Taliban is going to whoop our infantry in battle. Nah. They just snipe them and roadside bomb them. And nobody ever argued that our guys don't have the firepower to stay as long as they're within whatever the number is. I don't know. A few tens of thousands of guys required to protect themselves and each other from any, you know, likely or probable surprise attack or whatever the hell. Nobody doubts that the Americans can point laser pointers at their enemies and call in bombers to blast them and that kind of thing. But whoever thought that they could actually win Afghanistan and keep it and stay? That's crazy. And it always was not just crazy, but ridiculous and wrong and stupid and ultimately evil if you think of all the pain and the grief and the waste from this project all these years to lose anyway, all for nothing. It's horrible. It's as horrible as anything else on the planet right now. And then a couple here for you. Good news. Iran is meeting all of their commitments under the interim nuclear deal and all the technical parts of implementing it and everything. And the Syrians have gotten rid of about half of their chemical weapons, like in the deal, too. So that's pretty good. I am, yeah. Correct, I don't. I do. In my truck, huh? That sounds like a good idea. Best place to find it. Mm-hmm, I like the sound of that. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future of Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Yeah, I meant to mention to you guys, too, that Edward Snowden's TED Talk is really good. Let's type in Snowden and Ted, and it'll come right up for you there. It's only like 35 minutes, something like that. But I'd say worth your time. All right, good. On to our next guest. It's Gareth Porter the Great, independent historian and journalist, primarily for Interpress Service at ipsnews.net. Welcome back to the show, Gareth. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm good. Thanks very much for having me again.
Very happy to have you here. This will be interview part 6. On Gareth's brand new book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And we're basically going through chapter by chapter here. Thanks very much. You're very gracious with your time and your expertise on the show. I want to know
I think we're setting some sort of a record for a radio interview on a book.
Yeah, I think so. Well, and on this subject, too. I mean, yeah. Give me a break. Is there anything like it in world history? Probably not.
So,
let's see, I've interviewed you when we changed with the date in the title, it ruined it. But it used to be that the title of each interview at entry at scotthorton.org, it would say Gareth Porter number 125, Gareth Porter number 126 for using the same title over and over again, right? So we lost track somewhere right around 150, and then probably... Well, I don't know, what about half of those are on Iran, and then, of course, lots on Iraq and Afghanistan and other issues as well. But, yeah, we sure have covered this a lot, and I'm still learning all kinds of things, and that's why I have you on, because I want to know this stuff at least almost as well as you do. Because, it's very interesting to me, and, of course, it's a very important issue for peace on planet Earth and all of that, too. So, now the best I can do is read what you write and interview you about it. Manufactured Crisis, everybody, go and buy this book, would you? In fact, buy 10 of them and give them to people that you know and care about and are associated with and have met before. Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. All right, now, this chapter 7, is IAEA comes up empty. And I just love the way you did this. You just, case after case, I almost want to feel sad and a little bit empathetic with the IAEA guys. I can sort of see why they might be suspicious. Oh, I think we got them on this one. And then just case after case after case of hyped up accusation after hyped up accusation about Iran's nuclear program falling to pieces once all the documents are finally come forward. So just take us through it, because I think people remember, if anything, they're confused because, man, don't they know? that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. We're surprised they haven't nuked us all to death already, Gareth, because they've been making nuke bombs for years, I heard. And what it is what everybody heard is each and every one of these stories standing alone as more smoking gun evidence of what these guys have been up to that we've heard over the last decade.
Yeah, I mean, this whole story about the IAEA investigation of Iran's nuclear program that began really around late 2003, I guess you could say, is the starting point, and went up until the beginning of 2008 or the end of 2007, is really a very important part of the whole narrative because, you know, that's like 4 years of steady drip, drip, drip of stories. Like, you know, every 3 months you get an IAEA report that for a period of time nothing new was coming out, but for a while in 2004, 2005, you had a series of reports that, you know, almost every new report had something new that cast suspicion on the Iranian nuclear program because of some kind of issue that had arisen because of a discovery, you know, that the IAEA had made about some activity that had taken place, or a suspicion about one of the documents. They varied in terms of how it came about, but, you know, you've got one case after another where the IAEA was suspicious of something that had happened or that Iran had turned over to them, and decided that they were going to launch an investigation. And as you say, I mean, they clearly thought they were going to come up with some evidence in one or more of these cases that would indicate that, you know, they had evidence of a nuclear weapons program, and in every case they had a negative in the end. So, yeah, I mean, this is an important part of the whole storyline that in my book, which is that, you know, they did everything possible to come up with any shred of evidence that they could use to indict Iran as having a nuclear weapons program, and it was a failure all along the line.
Yeah, it's just like I remember my friend back in 2002 talking about, before the war in Iraq, but talking about the case for a war with Iraq and saying, you know, if you give each one of these a 1 or a 0, first of all, for even being true or not, but even accepting that they're true, give them a 1 or a 0 for whether they're good enough as an excuse to go to war, you end up with 0 times 10, maybe 0 times 20. Boy, that's a lot of excuses, but none of them are good enough. In this case, it's the same kind of thing with this evidence where it's just, you know, 0 times 20, you know, nothing but endless accusations, lots and lots of smoke, but then, oh, you know what, that's not even smoke, that's steam. There's no fire at all.
Right. Steam is good. Steam is good.
That's terrible. All right, so let's go through this. Laser enrichment, what are they doing with their lasers then, Gareth, huh? Defend that.
Laser enrichment was, of course, something that they had started to look at in 2003, and, you know, this was part of the report that was put out in late 2003. They were reporting on the fact that Iran had carried out both centrifuge enrichment and laser enrichment, and we've talked about this before, over a period of nearly two decades, was the general impression that was given. What if you look very carefully at the IAEA report that was issued first in November 2003 and then later in early 2004, the first one on the centrifuge very specifically, and the second one adding an important detail on the laser enrichment, what you found, if you read those reports carefully, is that there was no real enrichment taking place before these reports were written, that in fact the only thing that had happened was that they had tested the centrifuges with uranium, which is the only way you can do it, to make sure that they actually would work. before they intended to actually begin any enrichment. And by that time, as we've talked about before, in fact, they had not enriched any uranium. So that's what they reported in late 2003. And in the spring, I forget the exact date, 2004, they added a very important detail on the laser enrichment program, which was that, in fact, they did some experiments, but that, in fact, the experiments failed to achieve the result, which was the minimum necessary to have a viable program. It was like only one-third of the enrichment that was necessary that was actually achieved, and they basically realized that it wasn't going to work, so they had to give it up. That's what was actually reported in the 2004 report.
Mm-hmm. All right, and then so what about the highly enriched uranium? I remember this one being a real big deal back in the Bush years there, 2004 or 2005. They didn't say weapons grade 90 something, really above 94% to make a bomb out of it. They didn't say that, but they said highly enriched uranium and no reasonable explanation for this.
Right. Now this was a very important one because this was the first time that they thought that they had caught the Iranians doing high enriched uranium, HEU. And what happened was that when the Iranians tested their the centrifuges at the Calais Electric Company in mid-2003, they had made some low enriched uranium there, but the IAEA, when they took environmental samples, found traces of HEU, high enriched uranium. And so almost immediately, the IAEA put out a report saying, oh, look, we found evidence of HEU. This looks really bad. And it can't be, as you said, it can't be explained by anything that the Iranians have claimed. Now, the Iranians said almost immediately that this must be some imported parts that were contaminated. That was the explanation that they gave, and the IAEA safeguards department people, who, of course, as I think I've indicated on your show, and we'll talk about it again, I'm sure, are really hardliners. The first one, Goldschmidt, was somebody who had criticized El Baradei for refusing to refer in his IAEA report in September 2004 and June 2004 to the satellite photos that John Bolton wanted to have referred to in that report. In other words, you have Goldschmidt siding with Bolton in an issue where it was not real evidence of nuclear weapons intent or anything of the sort. It was simply photos of conventional, of potentially conventional explosives facilities. And so, you know, that indicates Goldschmidt's bent, and I talk about that in the book. And then you've got Ali Heinonen, who, you know, did not like the Iranians, did not trust the Iranians, and did everything possible to try to find evidence to show that they were having a nuclear weapons program. And this is a very good example of it. So Heinonen and Goldschmidt were still determined that they were going to prove that the Iranians, in this case, had produced high enriched uranium, and that must be evidence of a nuclear weapons program. Well, to cut to the chase here, it turns out that they finally had to call in an external group of specialists, and I think the circumstantial evidence is that El Baradei and his allies realized that Heinonen and Goldschmidt were really working against the interests of an objective investigation here, and they couldn't be trusted with this issue. And so they called in some external specialists to look at the evidence, and the external specialists very quickly came to the conclusion that this was indeed a case of contamination of parts that had come from abroad, that the Iranians had been telling the truth.
Right. And I remember that from back then, too. That, oh, it turned out just like they had tried to explain. Oh, this came from the Pakistani equipment that we bought. They
well, this apparently was not the Pakistani one. This was apparently Russian. Russian.
Right. Well, there were two different ones.
Yeah, there were two different ones.
Right. All right, hold it right there. We'll be right back with Gareth Porter in just a sec. Manufactured Crisis is the book. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, commercial break. Get out of my way. I'm talking with Gareth Porter. He wrote Manufactured Crisis, the untold story of the Iran nuclear scare. Now for sale at a website near you. Just type it in, Manufactured Crisis by Gareth Porter. And we were talking about the highly enriched uranium residue on some Iranian equipment that Ollie Heinonen and I forgot his first name, Goldschmidt, thought was going to be... I'm sorry?
Yeah, Goldschmidt, yeah.
Goldsmith, yeah, that they thought was going to be such a big deal, and it turned out not to be. And it was, the 36% stuff came from Russia, and then the 56% stuff came from Pakistan, from the AQCON network. Is
that correct? Yes.
And yep. Which piece was which? Does it matter?
Not really.
Okay. All right, let's go on. So, and then the telexes. Now, just before, just a few weeks ago, before I got the book, I guess after the book was out, you wrote a piece about this, and I interviewed you about it. So maybe we can give this a little bit of short shrift here. But this is another one where you could really see how some CIA guys might go, wow, look at seven things in a row that are dual-use items. I think maybe there's a front operation going on for the Iranian military here. But you say not only is it not right, but is it that they really should have known better too, Gareth?
Well, of course they should have known better. I mean, you know, this is a clear case of, you know, a little small tidbit or a few tidbits of ambiguous evidence. I mean, how can it be more ambiguous than dual-use equipment or dual-use technology? All of these cases that the intelligence analysts had in front of them, these telexes, involved the effort to procure either bottles of fluorine that can be used in, you know, a nuclear program, but obviously can be used for, you know, innumerable other applications. And the same thing for the other types of technology or equipment that were at issue here. I mean, you know, there's no inherent reason to go off half-cocked and say this is evidence of a nuclear program, except, as I've, you know, argued in the chapter that we'll get to later, that the intelligence community was primed to try to find information or analysis that would support the policy of the United States that suspected that Iran was trying to get nuclear weapons. So that's what was really going on. Now, in addition to that ambiguous evidence that I've just referred to, of dual-use equipment being procured on these telexes, there was also the telephone or the telex number of this physics research center, which, you know, Iran never denied the fact that that was a defense ministry-related outfit. So, you know, that was seen as the smoking gun. Oh, you've got the telex number. That must mean the military is using, you know, Sharif University, which was ostensibly where the these things were being ordered for, they're using for Sharif University as a front to carry out a military nuclear program. And that became the sort of mainstream idea that supported the policy of the United States to accuse Iran of intention of having nuclear weapons for a full decade during the 1990s. And it turned out, as the IAEA finally found out in 2007-2008, when the Iranians turned over all of the documents at the end of the work plan that had been agreed in 2007 with El-Baradei, it turned out that, in fact, the head of the former head of the PHRC, Physics Research Center, had been a faculty member of Sharif University and had been asked by all these other faculty members to help them get things for their students and for their own research. And the documentation was impeccable. The IAEA could not question any of it. So this closed the books on this. Unfortunately, as I've suggested on your show, I think, before, David Albright continues to try to put out the idea that that this is evidence of a secret military nuclear weapons program.
Right. All right, now...
He's still doing it today.
Why not? Indeed. So now I want to talk about the mine and the suspicions of military involvement in opening up a new mine instead of expanding the old mine and this kind of thing they thought was suspicious. But also, I'd like you to focus, if you could, for us a second on this uranium metal document, which say is sort of the engineering document for how to make hemispheres for a uranium nuke, but it's not the specific manufacturer documents of exactly how to do it. But so what is the significance of this?
Yeah.
Where did they get it, and what were they doing with it? Doesn't it say that they're guilty of something or something?
Right. No, this comes back to the episode that we discussed, I think, on the last program, or maybe it was the one before, where, you know, the Iranians were dealing with the AQCON network, trying to get a centrifuge technology, trying to get the blueprints for centrifuges and some parts to see how it worked. And the AQCON network threw in to the deal this 15-page paper, one page of which had the sort of general outline, the general outline of how you would create the hemispheric structure that is part of the process of building the contraption which you'd use for nuclear weapon. This is a formed metal, a uranium metal form that is part of a nuclear weapons apparatus. So what the AQCON network was doing was trying to interest them in buying the actual specs, the specifications for how to do this. This was basically an advertisement for that. It had none of the detail that would be necessary in order to know how to do it.
So in other words, it's just the same old answer, is they have it because we drove them to the black market to get the equipment for their civilian nuclear program, which is safeguarded and verified and everything
in general,
else.
That's right.
It came from the salesman from that black market.
It came from the salesman, and I asked Heinonen, when I interviewed him, did anybody ever contradict the Iranian positions that they did not ask for this? He told me no, nobody ever contradicted them.
And never mind any credible assertion that they did anything with it, or, you know, have a secret stash of uranium that they've diverted somewhere and that they've been practicing with the metallurgy involved
Nobody has ever claimed, the IAEA and Ali Heinonen never claimed anything of the sort. In fact, Heinonen, when he initially addressed this question in a briefing, if I remember correctly, for member states, he was quite forthright about it. He said, "No, look, this is not a blueprint for a nuclear weapon. It's not something that can actually be used to build a nuclear weapon. It's something much far short of that." And so he's basically saying, "Don't get too excited about it." But you know, I think the politics of this were such that he changed his mind, one has to believe that he talked to the Israelis and the Americans, and they convinced him that he should, you know, beat the drum about it, because that's what he ended up doing. And so it was turned into a political issue, despite the fact that he knew very well that it was not. You know, there was no real significance to that that document.
All right, now we got to skip the mine, but suffice to say that the mine and the plutonium and the those two specifically, those were just dropped as issues, which we can only conclude means that they were satisfied. They just didn't really say anything about it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a good indication, I should say, a good indication that essentially Heinonen was encouraged clearly by the Israelis, because the Israelis were the ones who knew that there was a connection between the Gashin mine and this firm called Kimya Madan, which they intended to introduce into the laptop document. Mm-hmm. So they wanted the IAEA to launch an investigation of the Gashin mine, and specifically the ore processing part of the mine operation. And that's because, as I say, they had already caught on to Kimya Madan having a contract for that ore processing center, and they had a document that linked Kimya Madan to some procurement request for something that was a dual-use technology, but that they were going to argue was very incriminating. So that's the origin of why, otherwise, mysteriously, the IAEA wanted to look into this Gashin mine. Nobody could figure out why they would want to do so, because there was no indication that there was anything amiss about it, and there was no indication that Iran had told a fib about the mine or anything like that. But it turns out, we know from Jackie Sanders, the U.S. representative to the IAEA at that point, in a speech, she later said, well, we think maybe it's not clear whether the Iranian military was really in control of this mine. So that was the secret agenda that was at stake in that. And as you said, I mean, you know, the IAEA found nothing to support that idea. And in fact, by 2007, well before 2007, Iran had turned over documents which showed very clearly that there was no military involvement in the Gashin mine. The Kimya Madan was simply made up of people who had worked for the Civilian Atomic Energy Organization before on the ore processing.
All right, now, and then the next interview will be all about the alleged studies. That's the next chapter of the book here. But we got to end up with, to finish up this chapter here very quickly, Gareth, El Baradei had this so-called work plan with the Iranians, where by the end, you say, of 2007, they had resolved all of these issues, and that's the same time that the NIC put out the National Intelligence Estimate saying that the CIA and the American government was satisfied that they didn't have a nuclear weapons program at all there, and you showed just how panicked the Americans were about that, about these issues being resolved when they want them to be outstanding
issues. Yeah, this is one of the things that I'm proudest of about the book, is that I was able to show that through the documents, the WikiLeaks cables,
right,
that the U.S. Was very determined to prevent the work plan success from having any political impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just goes to show what they're about. And then, of course, it's interesting that it's Jeffrey Pyatt, who is now the ambassador to Ukraine during this current crisis, is one of the guys quoted in there. And again, thanks to Chelsea Manning for leaking those documents.
People should never
forget, how grateful we got to be for the source of thousands and thousands of great news stories that have come out of those docs and proof of suspicions like yours that have come out of those documents. And all right, with that, I'll let you go, and I'll thank you very much for your time, and I will have you on KPFK on Sunday to cover the alleged studies documents and the smoking laptop. Gareth, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Scott.
Appreciate it. All right, everybody, that is Gareth the Great, Gareth Porter, author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, and he writes at ipsnews.net and at truthout.org, and he won the Gellhorn Prize, and he will be my guest on Sunday morning on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, and then probably, next Monday and Tuesday. We're going to cover this whole damn book. All right, thanks.